Hello everyone and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting are Caroline White, Deputy Editor, and Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. Make sure you stick around to the end of the podcast to hear Caroline's interview with Jimmy Carroll, who has just finished rowing the Atlantic.
Yeah, so Jimmy is co-founder of Polaris, that you may or may not know. It's a bespoke travel company that creates some really boundary-pushing, amazing adventures, often involving superyachts. So in that spirit of adventure, he took on the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge, which is a rowing race that takes teams 3,000 miles across open ocean from the Canary Islands to Antigua. He was on a tiny boat in a four-man team, sleeping in shifts in basically lockers. They had the most extraordinary experiences along the way, from meteor showers to a humpback whale breaching next to their little tiny boat and a blue marlin attack that nearly sunk them. But he will tell us all about that in the interview.
Yeah, it must be pretty wild being in mid-Atlantic at night and it's just the four of you and nothing around you but seascape. That sensation must be pretty wild. Right, before we crack on, there's a few housekeeping notes. The virtual boat show is ongoing and features some fantastic yachts, as we keep repeating on this podcast. The brokerage market is on something of a tear at the moment, so the virtual boat show is a great shop window for a lot of fantastic brokerage boats. So if you're in the market, go have a look. You might also be aware that there's a brand new, a newish social media platform out there called Clubhouse, which some of the BI crew are very excited about. So we'll be staging our very first room on the app today, if you're listening to this on Friday the 19th at 4 p.m. GMT. I'll be talking about the market with Edmiston CEO Jamie Edmiston. So if you're on the app, swing by and take part. We'll hopefully be having more of these conversations. So sign up to the app today and join us on there.
Oh, I've been obsessed with Clubhouse this week, largely because I can't get on it. I have this theory that, you know, whenever any new technology comes along, you have to jump on it and try and understand it so that you're not left behind. But at the moment, it only works on iPhone and I'm on Android. So I was kind of gutted and thought, oh, well, but it is all over my social media, my Facebook, my Instagram, LinkedIn. I keep seeing conversations of people like, oh, yeah, see you in the Clubhouse. And I have no idea what it is like. So I have finally dug out the world's oldest iPhone from the cupboard today. It's charging. And I've kind of caked the dust off it because, yeah, everyone seems, I think this is the new big thing and loads of people seem to be having very productive conversations. And given that no one can travel and kind of network at the moment, it seems like ideal timing. So I'm very excited. The build-up has been enormous. If I get on it and it's terrible now, I'm blaming everyone.
It is quite interesting. I've listened into a few conversations and even taken part in a few, and it is quite a novel experience. It is basically like being in a room having a conversation with a bunch of people, and the audio quality is quite good. So, you know, as a platform for kind of talking about news and views about superyachting, we're quite optimistic about it. So, yeah, if you can get on it, get on it. And then, yeah, and we'll keep having these conversations and it should be pretty, pretty enlightening. Well, fingers crossed anyway. So we should probably address the America's Cup, which is mired in a wee bit of controversy currently, with a few sharp comments being exchanged between the teams and organisers. So last weekend, the New Zealand government imposed a temporary lockdown in Auckland after a few cases of COVID were discovered, which had an impact on the Prada Cup final currently being contested between Luna Rossa and Ineos Team UK. So Ineos are currently losing the 13-race series 4-0, and races 5 and 6 were due to take place this week, but were necessarily postponed due to the lockdown. Now, organisers wanted the whole racing calendar to be postponed until all lockdown restrictions were eased to make sure as many people could watch the racing live and in person as possible. This might have meant racing recommencing in late February. So Ineos were supportive of this approach, but Luna Rossa kicked back quite strongly, which is in some way understandable, of course. They have the clear momentum, as they are winning 4-0 and are just three race wins away from taking the Prada Cup and progressing to the America's Cup match with Emirates Team New Zealand. But of course, you've also got to understand the point of view of organisers. They want to put on the best possible show and don't want an America's Cup that no one can watch. But Luna Rossa would not budge, with the result that racing will restart this weekend, albeit with several restrictions. The race village will be closed and spectator numbers will be severely restricted. And this has caused, well, some ill will. And Caroline, you're about to read a statement from, well, why don't you take over? You tell us what the chair of the America's Cup event said.
Yeah, it's a pretty punchy statement. I wish all press releases were this exciting. So this is from Tina Simmons, who is chair of the America's Cup events. She said, "Since Sunday, we've worked really hard on behalf of everyone in Auckland and all Kiwis to give Challenger of Record the opportunity to demonstrate some honour and respect for this country and delay the Prada Cup until we've had a greater chance of everyone being able to enjoy and benefit from being back into level one." Clearly, they've forgotten the words of their leader, Patricio Bertelli, at the opening press conference, who spoke about how privileged everyone is to be in Auckland without significant COVID restrictions, and that therefore everyone has a commitment and responsibility to deliver great sportsmanship and the Prada Cup to be a major sporting event. This plea has fallen on deaf ears, and it's clear that their focus is solely on Luna Rossa taking the Prada Cup rather than the greater good of the country, who have worked so hard in order to be in a position to stage this event. So, ow.
That is punchy.
Yeah, you don't often get statements like that. I mean, the America's Cup just seems to stir up people's emotions. So,
I was going to say, do you think it's fair to say it's the most controversial yachting event? Because it seems like, I know it's a difficult time, but it seems like every year there's so much drama. I think it's partly the nature of you know, the secret boats and everything like that. But it doesn't seem like there's ever been a year where it wasn't like that. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, there's a long history of sometimes bitter back and forth between teams and things. And spying and controversies. I mean, to be expected, I suppose. I mean, these teams are investing sometimes hundreds of millions into challenging for the cup. And so, I mean, Luna Rossa just want to win it, right? They're 4-0 up. They were supposed to do two races this week that were cancelled. And if they won them, it would have been 6-0. So they are basically on the precipice of getting into the America's Cup match with Emirates Team New Zealand. And they want to secure that as quickly as they possibly can. They have all the momentum. And the more time that, obviously, they're not racing Ineos, the more time between races for Ineos is more time Ineos have to kind of think, God, what did we get wrong in the first races? What can we improve for the latter races? So, I mean, that's one way of looking at it. The longer the delay, the greater advantage there is for Ineos to come back, I suppose. And we know Ben Ainslie has a long history of coming back in America's Cup events in San Francisco. And 2013, he jumped on Oracle Team USA's boat. So they were losing 8-1 in 2013. So, and then Ben got on the boat and they ended up winning. In 2013 in San Francisco, Ben jumped on Oracle Teams USA when they were 8-1 down and helped mastermind a comeback to beat Emirates Team New Zealand and win the America's Cup. So he's got a bit of history with coming back from against big deficits. So obviously, Luna Rossa will be very aware of that history, and they just want to get it over and done with.
It must be hard. I've been thinking that with other sports recently, with some of the rugby and football matches being postponed and stuff. It must be hard as a sportsman to keep psyching yourself up like that, to keep kind of mentally getting ready for your big race or your big match or whatever it is, and then having it put on hold and then suddenly have to get geared back up. You can see why they kind of want to keep the momentum, especially while they're on a kind of a winning streak like that. I don't think I would be keen to sort of, you know, put things on ice for a bit when you're so close.
Yeah, Luna Rossa have all the form at the moment. But, you know, the America's Cup event authority, they just want to put on the best possible show. So it's one of 6-1, half dozen the other, I suppose. I can kind of see both points of view. The outbreak has had the unfortunate consequence, though, of meaning the Millennium Cup has been postponed. So that was due to start this week. That is just the Super Yacht Regatta in the most beautiful part of the world, in the Bay of Islands in northern New Zealand. So that was due to start on the 15th. That's been pushed back to the end of March.
I would love to know from owners out there that have kind of gone down for the event what they're doing, whether they're deciding to just stay for longer, whether they're, you know, trying to change their plans around and come back later in the year. Because, you know, we spoke to all these people that had amazing itineraries planned. In a way, it could be quite cool if there's all this extra time you weren't expecting now to incorporate into your trip. But obviously, it's not ideal.
Well, I mean, you can't even get to New Zealand from Australia at the moment. So Marcus Blackmore, whose new boat Ammonite, Southern Wind Ammonite, he's in Australia now. So he was due to get the boat sailed across the Southern Ocean from South Africa to Sydney, as a, you know, what a shakedown that is. But he wanted the boat, here so he could get across to NZ for the Millennium Cup and the MasterCard Super Yacht Regatta. So he put it on the back of a ship. So it got to Australia in November last year. But then New Zealand, he couldn't then travel to New Zealand. The Aussies wouldn't let him out, he said, and New Zealand wouldn't let him in. So he was kind of stuck in Australian waters. But he's been enjoying the boat on the Pittwater north of Sydney, where he has a home. But it's a great shame because, you know, he hurried the boat across halfway around the world to go compete in his regattas, which he couldn't then compete in. But he's looking forward to Hamilton Island race week later in this year and Med in 2022, he reckons. So Charlotte, what's going on in the world of features?
Well, I have a nice story, actually. I've been reading a lot how over lockdown lots of adults have been subscribing to kind of adult bedtime stories and that people have been listening to podcasts. And I thought this was a nice sort of tale. It actually came up, I mentioned a few podcasts ago, we were talking about this feature about boats, famous boats that have been rescued that were wrecks. And it kind of got us thinking, well, what out there is still available to rescue? Because all these most amazing boats have been scooped up by someone who has the money and the passion to do them up. But there are still some incredible boats out there that are, you know, looking for homes and could be amazing. And this one popped up this week, and I thought it was just the most interesting story. So the boat's called Conador. She was built in 1939 by a naval architect called John Bain. She's just over 25 meters and she's teak and oak. And she is a bit of a project, not a wreck, but a project. So there's some serious work to be done. But unusually, there's an incredible amount of original features intact. If you have a look through the pictures, you can see everything from sort of inlaid wooden doors that are all original from the 30s to fittings out on the deck, just as they were. And unusually for this sort of boat, she's not suffered from the curse of lots of different owners taking her on, gutting her, making them their own. She's still very much as she was. And just the most interesting story behind her, she's being handled by the Sandemann Yacht Company down in Poole. And she actually assisted in rescuing over 1,200 soldiers at Calais and Dunkirk in 1940. You can even see the boat in paintings from the time, sort of out on the water. And the night before the Battle of Dunkirk, she was used to carry a handwritten message from Winston Churchill to Brigadier Nicholson on May 25th, when soldiers didn't have any working radios or any other lines of communication, but they wanted to get the message across. So Churchill wrote, "Calais must be held at all costs." And the boat carried that message across. It apparently was the toughest command he said he'd ever had to give. Anyway, the next day, when all the remaining ships left the port, Conador stayed right till the end, until the first tanks of the 10th Panzer Regiment burst onto the quay. And when they finally did try and leave Calais with 165 soldiers on board, disaster struck and the yacht ran aground. So you can imagine what people on board felt. Then they couldn't believe their luck when a nearby bomb explosion jolted the boat off the sandbank and Conador was at last able to make her escape.
What a story. That is fantastic. But I'm slightly more amazed they got 165 people on a 25-metre boat. Wowzers.
Yeah, it must have been absolutely crammed in, or maybe they, I don't know, I can't imagine how they did that either, to be honest. But can you imagine the feeling of thinking you'd escape, thinking you were done for, finally escaping? And actually, it's not just an interesting war story. I mean, during the war, she was used as an echo-sounding patrol vessel with submachine guns on board, kind of patrolling up and down the southeast coast of England. But she has a fascinating history of owners before and after, a lot of it very glamorous. And there's almost too much to say here, but I could go on about it forever, and I think not everyone would appreciate it. You'll have to read the full feature for the proper history. But she's done stints everywhere from Scotland to Saint-Tropez. At one time, she was owned by the owner who had also owned Endeavour at one time, and lots of owners who've also owned other big, famous, beautiful boats. Anyway, I hope that you don't hear this and buy it, because it will ruin my feature, which is due to come out later in the year. But if you do, then please get in touch and tell me all about it, and that can be the story that we swap it out with. But yeah, I just thought, what an amazing thing. If I was looking for a project to do up, that is a very special boat, looking for someone to just make it perfect.
Great story. So which issue are we planning that for?
That'll be later in the year at some point. It's a bit of an on and off, because these wrecks keep coming out, but obviously every time someone buys it, I have to go back to the drawing board. So hopefully that'll be in the second half of the year or slightly earlier. But coming up sooner than that, hopefully, for our adventure special in September, We're looking at a piece to do with owners who get seriously far away from civilization. So whether that's miles and miles and miles from shore, miles from civilization, or whether that's to the very bottom of the ocean, we're starting the research for that now. So if you're there in a sort of castaway type setting somewhere, talking to a Wilson basketball, and you would rather speak to me or somebody else from the boat team, or you've had amazing adventures in the past, please do get in touch and tell us. It's always interesting to hear from you.
Absolutely. Talk about the deepest points of the ocean. Carolyn, you wrote something for the recent issue about a submarine that can get down to the Titanic, and not one of these kind of tiny round porthole submarines that can get down to the Titanic, a proper acrylic glass bubble. Is that right?
Yeah. So they found, this is Triton submarines, they discovered that they could create a pressure hull that was strong enough to do this, spoke to their acrylic manufacturers and worked it out. And this thing has these kind of wings that fold out, so you can film from one wing and light your subject from the other wing, which is really useful for people who film, because apparently the worst way to film down at the bottom of the ocean is to light your subject and film it from the same direction. You get quite flat images. So what they usually do is they take two submarines down, light it with one, film it with the other. But with this one, you can do it all in one submarine. So it's spectacularly good value, I'm sure.
God, I hope someone buys that. I hope someone builds it. I hope, yeah, try to build it, but that requires someone to buy it. So come on, come on, explorers. All righty, Caroline, talk us through the news.
Yes, so the first 60-metre limited editions Amel's 200 superyacht has hit the water for the first time in the Netherlands. Key features include a hybrid propulsion package and a lift that will whisk guests between four decks. It also has an air-conditioned gym, which will sit on the sun deck, while full-height windows will flood the owner's suite with natural light. The interior is by Raymond Langton, and like all limited editions, the exterior is by Tim Hayward. And then some more news from a different brand under the same parent company. The 55-metre Darman yachting support vessel, Blue Ocean, has been sold and transformed into Gene Chaser to accompany the new Amel's 180 yacht Gene Machine. The newly refitted vessel has now got a custom fleet colour scheme to match the mothership. It's been revamped completely to meet the requirements of the new owner, Dr. Jonathan Rothberg. Much of the interior has been converted to accommodate scientific projects. The main saloon, for example, has been transformed into a lab, while other areas will be used for conferences and educational purposes. Accommodation will be for 8 visiting researchers or experts, while the crew area will allow for staff of 7 and 4 full-time scientists. Rothberg, who bought Gene Machine in 2015, said that Gene Chaser will be used as a next-generation lab to address mankind's greatest challenges.
I'm super excited to know more about this, because I interviewed some of the scientists working on board the main boat, Gene Machine, for that medical piece we ran in the March issue. And it sounds incredible how on the main boat, they just turned his office into a lab. And it is a proper lab with surfaces that you can use and fridges and all the bells and whistles and the kit. So quite why he needs more labs, I have no idea. How many labs does one person need? But I mean, it's so exciting. And it also got me thinking, every time I interview an owner now, they're sort of saying, well, actually, I'm looking for a different boat because I quite want to work on board and I want to live on board for longer periods of time. And I guess when I think of working on board, I think of a laptop, a notepad, and, you know, some boring stuff. But for some people, working on board could be a lab or some other crazy kit or facility. So it's interesting seeing these things come to light, I think.
Yeah. So one of the things the captain mentioned in this story was that this having this support vessel will allow the owner to separate his sort of family life and the work that they're going to do on board a bit more. So perhaps that lab on board could now become a more, you know, family space, and they move the operations for the exploration onto the support vessel. Or maybe everything's going to be for the exploration. I don't know, but it does allow more options for living on board rather than having to pack everything onto the mothership. In other news, Palumbo Superyacht's Columbus S50 has hit the water and been named K2. Styled inside and out by the Florence-based designer Luca Dini, key features include a vertical bow to increase the interior space. The saloon has also been designed to allow as much natural light in as possible, while lowered gun walls will ensure great views out to sea, even when you're seated on sofas, which I always think is a very sensible move. Finally, we have an update on Perini Navi. The Italian shipyard San Lorenzo and the Ferretti Group have joined forces to take over Perini Navi after the yard was declared bankrupt earlier this month. The two companies have announced a joint venture named NewCo, which is formulating a bid that entails the acquisition of Perini Navi's brands, assets and operations, a statement said. Ferretti Group CEO Alberto Galassi said the agreement safeguarded the activities of Perini Navi and suppliers should rest easy. San Lorenzo Executive Chairman Massimo Perotti added that he has a strong determination to save Perini Navi, which he described as an Italian brand with an unrivaled history.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to watch this one unfold. Some cooperation there between the high ups of the Italian superyacht marine industry. We'll see if they can collectively save Perini Navi brand and assets and projects. It'll be interesting to watch that one. We'll keep you posted. Now we move on to a subject very close to my heart, multi-hulls. Caroline, you've been looking at the stats on this one with Raphael. What can you tell us?
Yeah, I mean, this was partly sparked by the fact that Stuart will not stop going on about how catamarans are the future. So we thought we'd take a look at the market for multi-hulls of 24 meter plus to see if he's right, basically. So it's also slightly newsworthy as last week on the podcast, we reported that Silent Yachts has sold three of its 24 meter tri-deck catamarans. So it's something that's been in the news as well. There are 186 24 meter plus multi-hulls afloat. That's just 1.6% of the global superyacht fleet. The average length is 30.7 meters, but there are a few notable giants. The unusual 88-metre Aeacian Lady is the largest multi-hull yacht in the world, followed by the 84-metre trimaran White Rabbit, which was built by Eco Yachts. Most multi-hulls, 86.8%, are catamarans, but unusually, the numbers of sailing and motor yachts among the multi-hull fleet are almost equal.
Just a note on White Rabbit. So White Rabbit was one of my more extraordinary boats that I've ever seen, actually. Vast space on its main deck. Just, I couldn't believe what I was seeing when I went down to have a look at her in Fremantle in Western Australia. Yeah, amazing boat, built for a very pioneering owner. And actually, the reason I interjected was because you can read that report on our website now. So if you go to boatinternational.com and you're interested in White Rabbit, just search for White Rabbit and you can read all about her.
Thanks, Stu. Good tip. Looking to the future, according to our latest global order book, which takes into account yachts in build or on order between September 2019 and September 2020, we had a record number of projects underway. That's 29 projects. Compare that to the entire multi-hull fleet of 189 yachts. It's also 3.5% of the total number of superyachts in build or on order.
So what you're saying is the data supports my hypothesis.
I mean, incrementally. Yes.
I'm right, basically. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yes, just about right. The largest two projects currently under construction are support vessels. The biggest is called Wayfinder, a 68-metre already launched at Astillero Armon in Spain. Apologies for the pronunciation. That should be delivered this spring. That's the yard that delivered the support vessel Hodor in 2019, if you recall that one. The second largest is another support vessel of 56 metres. That one is currently under construction at Eco Yachts in Australia, which is the yard that built White Rabbit, the boat that Stuart just mentioned. Other interesting projects include the 35-metre Space Cat, the first catamaran for silver yachts, and also a 49-metre that will be the flagship of the Polish yard Sunreef.
So I spoke during the first lockdown, God, it seems a long time ago, last year, I spoke to Espen Oino, who is the designer of the Silviot Space Cat, and he's very much in agreement that multi-hulls have a very, very big future. So Silviots have invested quite a lot in this new line of multi-hulls, and they're cool looking things, actually. And again, just, you know, loads of space, the advantages are clear. Sorry, carry on.
No, that's all right. It's really selling this. Semi-custom multi-hull series are also worth mention, particularly two current success stories. So Sunreef has no fewer than 8 Sunreef 80s in the sailing yacht version under construction. The power version is just below 24 meters, which is why we're not mentioning that as well. Silent Yachts, meanwhile, has 7 orders for its new 80 series, the first one to be delivered this year. 3 of the 7 orders are the new tri-deck version, which is the one that we mentioned at the beginning of this segment. So, I mean, Stuart's clearly made up his mind, but it certainly sounds like interesting things are going on in the multi-hull world.
The future is multi-hull. You mark my words. Thanks, Caroline. Right now, stick around for our interview with Jimmy Carroll from Polaris.
Hello, Jimmy. So to start off with, do you want to tell us where you're speaking to us from?
So, I find myself today in Costa Rica. Having completed the row, we're on this side of the pond. And Jordi, my business partner, who I set up Polaris with, and myself and my wife and a couple of friends have rented a house here. And we've got this amazing location up in the jungle. And we're in a brilliant area called Santa Teresa, which is down in the Punta Arenas region. And it's pretty incredible with, dozens and dozens of species of birds and howler monkeys and all of that all around us. So, feeling rather privileged, but making the most of it.
Well, very jealous about that. But to make me feel slightly less bad, let's hear about your incredible row, which sounds incredibly challenging. So to start off with, tell us about the Atlantic Challenge. What was the challenge and where would it take you and how long would you be at sea?
So the Atlantic Challenge is set up by Atlantic Campaigns and it's sponsored by Talisker. So it formally goes, is known as the name of the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge. And it's a 3,000-mile row across the Atlantic, starting in La Gomera in the Canaries and ending rather pleasantly in Antigua. And I was part of a four-man team and we have a 28-foot rowing boat to get across the ocean in. And the estimation, in our kind of mind was that we'd complete that in 30 to 40 days. The world record for a four-man team is currently 29 days. And that was set back in 2017 with some pretty amazing conditions. So they were a great team, the four oarsmen who set that, but it's always going to be a challenge to do it. And so for our mind, completing it in any time from 29, 30 days through to 40 days it was a good accomplishment. Ultimately, we did it in 36 days, 5 hours and 10 minutes. It was pretty special. And we'll delve more into it, but it threw everything at us that it possibly could and then a lot more as well that we probably never dreamt of.
Fantastic. Okay. And I understand that you did this to raise money for the Polaris Foundation. Can you tell me a bit about that foundation and how it relates to Polaris as a brand?
Yeah, so absolutely. The foundation is something we set up in 2020 during lockdown. And really, it's a standalone registered charity with its own dedicated team, board of trustees, and it ensures it delivers far more than a traditional travel company foundation. And really, we wanted to do this because we didn't want to just be a company that said we support a charity and you kind of pay lip service to it. And really, the mission of the foundation is to protect, preserve and promote really at-risk wildlife and environments across the planet. And the goal of the foundation is to protect hundreds of square miles of wilderness by 2025. How do we do this? It'll be achieved by creating and building on projects that accelerate the pace and change towards a more sustainable future. And that is a spread of projects across marine and land-based programs in partnerships with local charitable partners and other charities across those areas as well. So we really drive our funds into those projects and those charities to have the greatest impact and to really bring on those areas, but also look at the local communities. And certainly through Polaris and where we travel to, this is a really good initiative because everywhere we go, we want to leave a positive impact. And not just by taking people there, but also by having this integral part of our DNA delivering on these projects.
Fantastic. Sounds like a very worthy cause. So turning to the boat specifically, so you've signed up for this incredible journey. Can you tell us a bit about the boat? Could you pick it yourself? What was the setup on board? How would you live?
Yeah, so I came with great ideas, having been the head of marketing and communications and BD for Winch Design, and seen all the glamorous boats that they used to design and across the industry, and obviously always reading Boat International every month and seeing what wonderful boats are in there. It's not quite the same in the rowing, ocean rowing community. And so we actually had what is called an R45 boat, which is 28 foot long and built by Rannoch. We were lucky enough to have a brand new boat, and we actually got it a month before departing. And it would have been great to have that earlier, but because of COVID and what have you, we weren't able to train on it. And also everything was impacted, as we know. But the boat is 28 foot, as I said. There's two cabins, one in the bow and one in the stern. The bow cabin is actually, that's the real penthouse of them. And for most yachties, that would be certainly the master suite, the owner's cabin. And then the stern is probably more akin to a jump bed, a pull-out pullman for additional crew. But in the stern, you have everything from the radios, the electrics, the battery monitors, the GPS and navigation systems, and then also the auto helm, which is vitally important. So the real task is not just the space, but also then the management. I've somehow found myself in the stern cabin with Todd, who's our largest team member, who's 6 foot four, ex-pro rugby player. Luckily, he's lost a lot of that 120 kilo stature and come down to 99 when we started. But it's still a tight squeeze. And we were able to customize the boat a fair amount by having lithium ion batteries put on board. You also have a water maker on there, which is making us between 30 and 40 litres of water a day, and a few other tweaks to it. We were also sponsored by Inmarsat, so we had a Fleet One sailor system on there provided to us by Advanced Tracking. And so a few items that we added to it. And then the boat itself, you can row three people up at any one time. And then also you obviously have the ability to hand steer, which is something that we learnt that was vitally needed at certain different points in the crossing. And then the safety system, really you could cut the boat in half, and those two cabins and the two sections of the boat would completely float themselves, which is great. They're very, very stable boats. And obviously have a life raft on, and then we're clipped in all the time because there are no sides to the boat. The sides come up only a couple of inches from when you're sat down, and then you have a few safety strops going down the side. So you're wearing essentially a climbing harness with all the additional items cut off, and then you're on a safety leash into the kind of superstructure of the boat. And when you realise in the Atlantic that trying to turn the boat around, there is no motor. So if someone did go overboard, the new normal man overboard drills for a motor yacht or sailing yacht just are nearly impossible to do. So you really ensure you are clipped in all the time. And when you're in a 30 or 40 foot swell, you realise that even more.
Well, that sounds frankly terrifying. Can you tell me how do you prepare for something like that, both physically and mentally? I understand you're dealing with things like sleep deprivation, salt sores, physical extremes, obviously. How do you prepare?
Great question. I think so many people think this is a 100% physical undertaking. We did a lot of work into this, and I am glad to say that my assumptions before the race and now looking back on it and going, kind of making the review of how we coped was that actually it's 60% mental, 40% physical. We're very lucky on the physical side that we had an amazing physical coach called Gus Barton, who really brought us up to standard for of an ocean rower and beyond. And that was concentrating on a lot of it was erg work on the rowing machine, the Concept 2, some hideous sessions on that. I probably never want to get back on one again. It's an item of torture. But then also a lot of gym work, which was interesting because of lockdown. So we had to, you know, do as best we could during the first lockdown. But also a lot of core stability and mobility in there as well. I'm a classic male who's probably not done a huge amount of mobility training, and having played a lot of rugby and been in the army and what have you, not concentrated on that as much. So trying to kind of bend down a touch of toes was hard at the beginning. Now I'm embarking on yoga and all sorts of things. So that was certainly the physical side. But then the mental preparation, and again, kind of jokingly say, but I think we're now moving into an era where men certainly talk about their mental health a lot more than they ever have done. Women have always been much better at this and talking about their emotions and their feelings. But we've really challenged ourselves here to understand all of our strengths and weaknesses as a team, our touch points, different emotions that we've been through, different feelings, not just lockdown, because that's brought a lot of this to the top of people's, you know, thinking now, but also, you know, different elements of the home life, if you're potentially going to be homesick, how people are coped under stressful situations. And yeah, talking through all of this was one of the biggest moments. It was very cathartic, but also allowed us to think, actually, when we're in a situation where we are tired, hungry, in an alien environment in the middle of the Atlantic, that we knew where people's strengths and weaknesses lied and actually how we dealt with that. And I'm so pleased that we did that, because there's many situations throughout our crossing that we actually realized that we really needed to talk to each other and, you know, and understand where people are at, because actually it's very easy to bottle it up. And when you're on that small boat with no escape, and there is no privacy at all on the boat, you really got to express how you feel, so things don't bubble over. So it's a big part of it. And then that aside, we also need to do some training on the boat as well. So we had to do a mandatory 120 hours out on the boat. And we did that out of Burnham on Crouch, where Rannoch HQ is, and then straight out into the North Sea, which was a bit of a baptism of fire, which is great. And we thought we saw some pretty tough conditions out there, with kind of 35 knot winds and gusting, and, you know, having to row three up to get back in because we're doing one knot an hour and what have you. But it was nothing in comparison to what the Mid-Atlantic threw at us. So all in all, those different areas. And then the final bit is really the coaching that we went through with Angus Collins, who is also our weather router but ocean coach, and really prepping us for all of those different bits. So sea survival courses, VHF radio courses, and a number of others, medical courses as well, and then also the ocean rowing course. So there's quite a bit of training which goes together. Ultimately, outside of the gym work, we had about 5 months to cram that all in because of COVID, and also that one of our teammates, team captain Dixon McDonald, was based in the US as well, so he had to come over to the UK on a couple of occasions to get all of these mandatory courses together and be able to complete them as a team. So it wasn't the easiest of rides to get to the start line, but actually probably bonded us even more than normal.
Absolutely. So when you did get to the start line, can you tell me about some of the experiences that you had along the way during the actual row, both good and bad?
Before we started, we war gamed, and it's a military term of, you know, looking at every scenario, how you may deal with that and what these potential scenarios are. And we went through pretty much what we thought were all of them. And that was from big weather, storms, items on the boat breaking, how you'd repair them, seasickness, and other injuries, and how you operated as a team. And that was a really useful exercise. I think what we didn't encounter, what we didn't think of, is that we potentially encounter all of those different scenarios. We are very lucky that we only had a very mild case of seasickness. Johnny Mawson suffered from that for a day or so. But that came in line with one of our biggest challenges on day three, when we lost all of our power and everything went down. So we had no navigation, no radios, no water maker, which is vitally important. And we had to hand steer. And that involved then us getting on a satellite phone to Rannoch and to Angus. And then we spent the next kind of 6.5-7 hours hand steering the boat, whilst I then rewired the electrics and the battery system on board. Not something I didn't kind of thought I'd have to embark on, but luckily had gone and done the electrics course at Rannoch with Todd, so we knew a little bit. But being upside down in a locker, trying to get your arms in, but also making sure that the wave doesn't come over and flood the locker with the batteries on, was pretty nerve-wracking. So that was one of the first encounters. Obviously, the nature of where we were always going to kind of expect big seas and rough weather. And we've been told about rogue waves which come in and hit you. And we got struck by two enormous waves that completely engulfed the entire boat. Todd and Dixon were on the deck at the time rowing, and both of them nearly capsized us. And it's hard to capsize the boat, but they do auto rotate and bring you back up. So we always had confidence that, you know, we would be okay if that did happen, but it's still not a pleasant experience. And on the second wave that came over, that snapped an oar clean in half. So you kind of realize the power of the waves, and as you're pushed off the seat and up against the side rails and then nearly out, you're glad you got the harness on and what have you. But then that's mixed with incredible wildlife, and seeing, not exaggerating, probably over 1,000 dolphin over an hour and a half. And obviously, as you're rowing, you're always facing backwards. And every wave that came over from behind, and we'd ride the waves, which is a great way of picking up some speed and some free miles. But in every wave, there's 20, 30, 40 dolphins coming over, and you can see them playing. And then they come up to the boat and alongside, and then just be dancing around the bow. It was mind-blowing. And I was actually in the stern cabin, and you can hear the dolphins. And they're squeaking and what have you, because the stern cabin's below the waterline when you're lying down, and your ear is against the fiberglass hull, and you can hear them all. It's just unbelievable. Mix that with a meteor shower one night, seeing over thousands of shooting stars. Every time you look left and right, you would see another 10 or 20 shooting stars, and this just went on for hours. It was unbelievable. I think the only way you can imagine it is being sat in an IMAX theatre and just, you know, having that huge screen around you and just looking either way, and you can just see, you know, this enormous light display in front of you. And then that was only topped by the night sky and the stars, which are incredible, by this large meteor shooting star, which Dixon and I saw one night. And it had the most enormous glowing fire ball, which is blue and green, and then a tail which must have stretched hundreds of meters. And it started with what was like a flash of lightning, boom, and we looked up and we thought it was lightning and there was a storm coming in. And then as we looked directly up, this bolt just came across the whole of the night sky and lit up the entirety of the sky, and must have burnt for about 40-45 seconds. It was mesmerizing, and we were lost for words. I kind of shouted that and pointed up, and then just went, wow, and just sat there kind of on the oars and just took a minute to really, you know, take that in. So yeah, those are pretty incredible. Humpback whale, 50 meters from us, breaching, and its fin coming out and slapping down. And then, you know, a few minutes later, the blowhole going off. it was close enough. I don't think we would like to have seen her any closer. 50 metres, yeah, when you're such a small boat and the whale is certainly a lot bigger, you really don't want to be any closer. And then, obviously, we might come on to it in a minute, but we had a certain encounter with a marlin. So I don't know if you want to touch on that now or in a bit.
Yeah, let's go for it. So you were basically attacked by nature. Is this right?
Yeah, so it was a funny discussion before. We said, you know, shall we take a fishing line and do a bit of fishing? And we were very concentrated on going out for the race win, and fishing potentially would slow you down and what have you. But then also we're like, well, let's just try and be at one with Mother Nature and the ocean. And, you know, we're racing for the Pluris Foundation and conscious of all of this. And so actually we didn't do any fishing at all. 1,000 miles from the end, 10 days out, it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we were chasing down the lead team, and it was turning into a really good race between us, and we'd just overtaken a team that were in the lead for about 10 days before. And in the afternoon, I was on my off shifts. So I was in the stern cabin, and you know, we rowed 2 hours on, 2 hours off throughout the duration of the row. And you only really get about an hour and 20 minutes of sleep maximum in that 2 hours off. And you don't get much sleep in the day at all because it starts to get too hot. So on a good day at the beginning, you probably get 6 hours sleep. And then towards the end of the race, you're maximizing maybe five. And so it's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was trying to get some sleep. I was lying down in the stern cabin. And in the stern cabin, you only got your torso in the cabin part, and then your legs are actually underneath the deck. And so there's not a huge amount of room there, as I mentioned. And suddenly, all I heard and experienced was this a mighty bang. And I thought it was another one of these huge, giant rogue waves, because the sound echoed and reverberated around the cabin. And so my immediate thought was actually the boys had been hit by this wave and completely engulfed. So I immediately shouted out to Todd and Dixon, who are on deck again, saying, "Are you okay?" And they're like, "Yeah, we're absolutely fine, but it's not a wave, but we've been hit by something pretty serious." And they said, you know, looking back, the only way you can experience it is if you've been rear-ended in a car, that shunt that it gave you, and it must have moved us 2 or 3 foot. And at first they thought maybe it was a shipping container that, you know, sunken that we'd seen hit, or something else, you know, floating debris in the ocean. And then Todd looked down, and actually this fish swam away, and it must have been about 10 foot in size. So they said, "Are you okay? We think we sustained some serious damage." And I was like, completely blasé, you know, half asleep, semi-dazed, absolutely fine, no dramas at all. And I said, "Are you sure, Jimmy?" I said, "Yeah, fine, everything's okay in the cabin." Lay back down, and then about a second to 2 seconds later, I must have shouted with more expletives than you can imagine, because my feet are wet in the cabin. And I look down by my thigh, and there's this 10 inches of marlin bill coming through the hull of the boat, through the mattress, and a centimetre from my thigh. And at first, I wasn't sure what on earth it was. I thought it was a plastic spike. I was like, how on earth could this got here? What is it? I ripped the mattress off and then realised that it's slightly barbed and rubbery, and actually it was from a fish, and you know, maybe a swordfish family or what have you. And then realised, rather alarmingly, it put a hole in our hull and penetrated the hole. And it was about between 6 and 7 centimetres in diameter. And we're starting to take on quite a bit of water. So notified the team, and the immediate action was to get the satellite phone out and call the race control back in the UK, notify them of the situation. Ian Couch, who's the head safety officer for the race, is also an ex-military man. And we kind of kicked back into what it would have been like back when in Afghanistan on tour, and that kind of passage of information in a high pressured situation. It was good, very good to have him on the end of the line. And then we had to set about, you know, what we're going to do. And Jono came down and started to help with me. We stripped the cabin out. Slightly awkward that quite a lot of time you're naked on the boat. We did row in kind of cycling shorts a lot because it was just a lot easier. But when you're down, you need to kind of get air to your body. And you know, as you mentioned, salt sores on your derriere, etc. So I was sleeping naked, and I then found myself naked for the next kind of 6.5 hours with Jono trying to help me in the cabin. And I think if anyone had passed by, they would have found it very bizarre. But we had this flooding cabin, so we used the hand pump to pump out about 2 foot of water, but then it continued to flood over the next 5 hours as we repaired the boat. And we realized that we couldn't pull the bill out or push it down, so we had to hacksaw it off at level with the floor, and then go about trying to fix it. And very luckily, they send you off at the beginning of the race with epoxy resin on board. And what we did, we used epoxy resin to fix it. And we made probably a size of a golf ball or slightly larger, half a tennis ball size ball of the epoxy mixed, and then plugged that into the hole left by the marlin bill. But that didn't seal it because there's lots of water coming around the edges. So then we used a petal effect to work our way around the rest of it. But the epoxy takes about 40 to 45 minutes to set each time you apply it. So, yeah, the whole process from when we got hit at about 2:15 took about 6.5 hours. And we were back rowing and underway by 8:30. But it wasn't just about doing the internals. We then realized that Jono got in the water and looked underneath, and we still had about 2.5-3 inches of the bill firmly wedged in the underside of the boat. And so we applied some epoxy around that to make sure it didn't come loose and potentially crack the epoxy on the inside. And it held firm, and we did the final 1,000 miles with all of that in place. What we didn't realize is where it was double skinned, the boat, just at that point, that we'd taken on approximately about 45 litres of seawater as well. So we were all merrily thinking that we're losing body weight. I lost 8 kilos during the race, and I think that was about the average for each of us. We're eating our rations, so all of that weight's going down as well, thinking, great, the boat's getting lighter, we're going faster as we get in. Actually, we took on 45 kilos of additional seawater, but that was a good price to pay to be able to finish the race. And at one point, I think we thought that this was it. We may not be finishing the race. The boat may actually sink because we're taking on so much water. And also that moment that Jono was ex-army as well, and looked at me and said, we don't even want to think, and God forbid that bill wasn't a centimetre further to the right, because it would have gone straight through the middle of my thigh. It could have struck anywhere further up, and that would have been a catastrophic bleed, and we wouldn't have been able to do much about that. 1,000 miles out, wouldn't have been much hope at all. So, thank goodness, because otherwise it would have been a very different ending to the race. But a hell of a story. And I now have a marlin bill in my bag with me here in Costa Rica, which will be coming home and be mounted and be a bit of a trophy and a story to hopefully tell the grandchildren in years to come, and anyone else who wants to listen.
Absolutely. So as you say, a hell of a story. So tell me about the ending. Where did you come in the race? Almost forgotten it was a race, your incredible experiences, but where did you come in?
Yeah, so good question. That our mantra and everything we wanted to do from the beginning was to go out and win this race. And I think we realised before that ultimately there's a couple of goals that we wanted to win, but actually we needed to all come back as friends. And it's a very high pressured environment, and there have been incidents before that hasn't been the case with teams. Ultimately we didn't win the race, and we came in second place, 22 hours behind the leaders. But it was a hell of a race, and there's actually three teams really in the running, which was great. And the team that came in third came in kind of 24 hours behind us as well. So it was a great challenge there. Where did we arrive? We arrived in English Harbour in Antigua, which is just fantastic. Arriving in Antigua is a great place, and been out there for the yacht show, and you know, and listeners and readers of Boat International know how wonderful it is, and one of those staple places on the winter yachting scene for the Caribbean. And the Antiguans really do, you know, warmly welcome you, and so does the whole community, and the yacht community are brilliant. I'd watched a lot of videos and things of the race before and seen the finish line, but actually nothing prepares you, and you were lost for words as you came in. I was very lucky that I was steering the boat, because we moved to hand steering as we came in, and we had three guys rowing. But hand steering meant I was facing forward and could see everything unfolding. And the Antiguan Coast Guard come out and meet you a couple of miles out, and they guide you in. And then actually our friends and family came out on a boat a couple of hours beforehand and actually got to see us rowing, which was in the ocean right out there, which is a really great feeling to actually see it, not just living it through Instagram and our stories, but to actually see us rowing on the open ocean. And then we had a small flotilla behind us, people from like the Mill Reef Club in Antigua coming out, friends on pedalos and kayaks. And then you come in past the fort in English Bay, and the official race line, finish line is there, and there's flares going off up on the fort. And then all the yachts in English Harbour start sounding their horns. It was awesome. Yeah, the only experience I've ever had of that before is, on all the occasions of the yacht shows, Monaco Yacht Show and Antigua and everything, when all the yachts sound their horn at the end, and it puts the hairs up at the back of your neck. And having that just for you is just amazing.
Yeah, incredible story. So do you plan to do anything like this again? What's next for the Pelorus Foundation? Maybe a bit too soon to ask you.
I think it's in the nature of my character to definitely do stuff again. Yeah, I've got unfinished business to go back and finish climbing Everest after leading a medical research expedition there back in 2013. There's definitely some other things. As Pelorus Foundation, actually, just prior to coming on to speak, we're having a call with our head of marketing, Hannah, and just talking about the foundation and everything, and that actually everyone at Pelorus gets a charity day to do something for the foundation of their choosing and going out. So we're just looking at what that may be. It doesn't all have to be as challenging as rowing the Atlantic by any means, but no, certainly there's some goals to go and achieve. And I think there's a few of us from the row who will be teaming up again to go and conquer something, be that on land or sea. So definitely some plans being made. Over a few more beers, so that seems to be the best place for crazy ideas to come to fruition.
Absolutely. Well, Jimmy, thank you so much for your time, and I hope you enjoy your Costa Rican paradise, and hopefully speak to you again soon.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.